Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Nayman of the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about why he believes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial March 3rd speech to a joint session of Congress was a call for war. Activist Charles Chandler, who explains why he's walked hundreds of miles and risked arrest to focus public attention on the urgent issue of climate change. And Craig Aaron of the media democracy group FreePress.net, who discusses the significance of the recent FCC vote that established new net neutrality rules to preserve an open internet and the battles that still lie ahead. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Days before Myanmar's Union Day, which celebrates the Southeast Asian nation's independence, a fierce battle broke out between ethnic Chinese rebels and the National Army, raising new questions about President Thein Sein's ability to end decades of civil strife. Ethnic Chinese Kokang fighters are led by Peng Jiasheng, a former commander of the Burmese Communist Party who was driven out of the Kokang region by Myanmar army troops in 2009. The offensive by Jiasheng's Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army made a strong push to take control of the regional capital of Lakai, but faced an intense counterattack by government troops. Thus far, more than 130 rebels and army soldiers have been killed, and over 30,000 refugees have fled across the border into China. On February 17th, President Thein declared a state of emergency in the region. Other ethnic militias have also launched attacks against the Myanmar army. These groups include the Ta'ang National Liberation Army in northern Shan State and the Arakan Army in western Burma. For months, President Thein has been engaged in talks with 16 armed ethnic groups over a proposed ceasefire. Yet talks have broken down over government insistence that the rebel groups disarm before any power-sharing agreement can be reached. Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner has criticized Myanmar for backtracking on the rights of ethnic and religious minorities, freedom of expression, and the right of peaceful protest. New Mexico farm worker Israel Morales usually makes between $4,000 and $7,000 a year picking chilies. Most of the money is sent back to his wife and two teenage children living in Mexico. But only a fraction of his income is reported to the Internal Revenue Service and the Social Security Administration, undermining the farm worker's ability to get benefits like unemployment. Morales, who works for two farm labor contractors, filed a tax return in 2012 for his income of $6,800, but he was never sent a W-2 form by either of the contractors. Still, his payslips show nearly $200 was deducted from his paychecks for Social Security payments. When contractors fail to report a worker's income to the Social Security Administration, it undercuts their ability to receive future retirement benefits. According to the news magazine In These Times, farm labor is dominated by a system of dishonest contractors in an informal agricultural economy. Contractors usually pay in cash, and most farm laborers do not keep pay stubs. The IRS says paying workers in cash is a common method by which employers can avoid reporting earnings and paying employment taxes. The Guardian reports the Chicago Police Department operates an off-the-books interrogation center in Holman Square, where suspects, including political activists, have been detained for hours off the official booking database, beaten by police, and handcuffed for long periods of time. Brian Jacob Church, known as one of the NATO Three, was detained in the Holman Square Interrogation Center following a preemptive police raid before anti-NATO summit protests in May 2012. The activist was restrained by police for most of a day, denied access to a lawyer, and not informed of his Miranda rights. Church was later transferred to a local police station where he was charged with terrorism-related offenses. Church and his fellow NATO protester Vic Suter are two of the first detainees at Holman Square to speak publicly about their detention. 2 years ago, John Hubbard was taken to an interview room in the Holman Square complex, which also houses undercover anti-gang and anti-drug squads. He was found unresponsive and later declared dead. The Cook County Medical Examiner pronounced the cause of death as a heroin overdose. In response to the Guardian expose, There are now calls for a U.S. Department of Justice probe into the abuses at Homan Square. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Two weeks before Israeli elections, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress on March 3rd. The widely covered speech erupted into controversy after Republican House Speaker John Boehner invited Netanyahu without consulting the White House, a breach of standard protocol. The focus of the Israeli leader's speech was also contentious for its effort to derail the Obama administration's ongoing nuclear talks with Iran being conducted with UN Security Council members in Germany. In his address, Netanyahu repeated his view that no deal with Iran was better than a bad deal and urged Congress to impose new sanctions on Tehran that would require overriding a promised presidential veto. Nearly 60 Democratic lawmakers boycotted the speech owing to what they believe was the obviously partisan nature of the event. According to a February 17th public opinion poll, a large majority of Americans also believe the GOP leaders were wrong to have invited Netanyahu to speak to Congress without consulting the White House. Before the speech was delivered, more than 180 former commanders in Israel's security apparatus urged Netanyahu to cancel his address to Congress, declaring that the prime minister's policies were damaging U.S.-Israeli relations and bringing Iran closer to obtaining nuclear weapons. Your reporter spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director with the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about why he believes Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial March 3rd congressional speech was a call for war with Iran.
Clearly, this is about the Israeli election. Poll in January, an Israeli poll in January, said that two-thirds of Israelis thought that this trip to Washington was about the Israeli election. You know, they could be, two-thirds of Israelis could be wrong, but they're watching the situation up close, so I think that's an important piece of data. And you ask yourself, why did this have to happen exactly right now, 2 weeks before the Israeli election? Couldn't happen after the Israeli election. Couldn't happen, you know, a month ago. Why exactly right now? And Netanyahu's answer to that is, well, you know, there's a March deadline coming up in the talks, which is true, but the March deadline is after the Israeli election. And also, you know, the broad contours of this thing have been clear for a long time. It didn't suddenly become the case that the U.S. was trying to get a diplomatic agreement with Iran. And the agreement that the U.S. and its partners have been trying to get, the broad outlines of it have been known for a long time. So it's not like the Israeli government is suddenly surprised by what the U.S. is trying to do. So clearly that's one motivation. It's longstanding Israeli policy to oppose what they see as a bad deal from the point of view of the Israeli government. In their ideal world, Iran would have no nuclear program at all, and they oppose a deal in which Iran has any nuclear program whatsoever. So that's not new. What's new about the situation is Netanyahu and his lieutenants and supporters openly trying to blow up the talks. His deputy foreign minister, in defending Netanyahu's plan to go to Congress, said he has to go to try and get more votes in the Senate to override Obama's veto of new sanctions against Iran. So that's kind of a remarkable statement. That was the deputy foreign minister in the interview explaining why does Netanyahu have to go to Washington. He has to go to Washington to essentially lobby Congress to override President Obama's expected veto of new sanctions. Now, there's no real dispute that if Congress passes new sanctions now, that would violate the interim agreement with Iran. That would blow up the talks.
In all the talk about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his concern about Israel's survival in the face of a nuclear Iran sometime in the future, it's rarely talked about that Israel is estimated to have some 75 to 400 nuclear weapons itself. So the threat of a nuclear Iran against Israel's survival seems pretty remote, given the fact that Israel could turn the whole nation of Iran into dust if they dared to launch an attack on Israel. And for all the negatives you can say about the mullahs that control Iran, they're not suicidal.
Well, in fact, this is a key point in dispute. That's at the core of their argument. Iranian leaders are not rational. They're not like other governments that the U.S., other enemies that the U.S. has dealt with in diplomacy in the past. They're different. They're different from the Soviet Union, different from China, different from Gaddafi's Libya. They're in this other category. They're fundamentally crazy. That's what these people believe, or that's what they claim to believe. So according to them, there's no such thing as nuclear deterrence between Israel and Iran because the leaders of Iran are fundamentally crazy. They're not rational actors. That's not how the U.S. government perceives it. That's not how the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies perceive it. That's not how the U.S. military perceives it. And we already had this debate in the National Intelligence Estimate. The U.S. government professionals, whose job it is to assess these things, said, we assess that the leaders of Iran are rational actors.
When you look at Benjamin Netanyahu and his government's opposition to these negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, it seems that the only alternative they are offering in place of negotiations is airstrikes, is a war, launching a full-blown war. As I look at the comments from Netanyahu and officials in his government, I see no other option that they have on the table. How do you see it?
You're practically quoting President Obama. Obama administration officials are saying exactly the same thing. What's the alternative besides war? What's the alternative? And President Obama also just today said, you know, the fact of the matter is that a negotiated agreement will do more to give assurance against the future possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapon than either military action or sanctions. Most analysts believe that airstrikes could set back but not eliminate Iran's nuclear capacity and would just give them an incentive to speed up, accelerate efforts towards acquiring a nuclear weapon, at the same time giving them an excuse in the context of international business. Say, look, Dave, we were negotiating, then they attacked us. Of course we have to protect ourselves. So they haven't offered any alternative besides the military conflict. And that's not surprising. And these are the same people that brought us the Iraq War. Netanyahu, as Secretary of State Kerry recently pointed out, he was a champion of the Iraq War. The people supporting Netanyahu now are people who were champions of the Iraq War. These people have a magical belief in the efficacy of military force, despite what happened in the last 10 years when we saw that, you know, overwhelming use of military force by the United States did not bring about the results that were promised.
That was Robert Nayman, policy director with the group Just Foreign Policy. For more perspectives on current Iran nuclear negotiations and Netanyahu's speech to Congress, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ithaca, New York resident Charles Chandler took up long-distance hiking after retiring from his profession as a mechanical engineer. He first began hiking as an athletic hobby, but when he learned about 398 students who were arrested during a 2013 protest against the Keystone XL pipeline at the White House, from then on he began walking with a purpose. His concern about climate change led to his participation in the Great March for Climate Change last year, walking partway from Ohio to Washington, D.C. He also rode his bike from Fort Bragg, California to Richmond, Virginia, raising funds for the climate action group 350.org. Chandler's most recent walk began in central New York State, where he joined locals trying to stop a natural gas storage facility from being located under Seneca Lake. He then walked 360 miles to southern Maryland, where he went on trial in late February for his involvement in a civil disobedience action last December at the construction site of a liquefied natural gas export terminal at Cove Point, Maryland. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chandler as they walked in the town of Lusby, near the LNG terminal site. Here he recounts his experiences as a climate activist and explains how he stays hopeful despite the threat of climate chaos.
Actually, on the Pacific Crest Trail in fall 2013, I heard about college students getting arrested in Washington over the KXL pipeline. And I said, I darn well want to join up with them. You know, it's really my generation that's probably caused most of the problems, and just gotten carried away with denial and carbon polluting, and just not taking responsibility. So I really feel a responsibility to help the younger people and future generations. Hopefully we'll solve this problem.
So tell us more about some of the specific things you've done. Like the most recent one, I know you just walked several hundred miles from Ithaca, I think, where you were working with folks trying to stop a project in Seneca Lake. Is that right?
At Seneca Lake, I took part in a blockade at the Crestwood facility. As it turned out, I wanted to go to jail, but the judge up there wouldn't let me. And he ordered me to come back to court about 4 weeks later. For something to do, I decided to walk around the Finger Lakes area. I started at Ithaca, and I walked around Cayuga Lake, and then I walked around Seneca Lake. And then finally, I ended my walk at the courthouse for my hearing on January 21st.
And what happened at that point?
It was obvious that no one was going to jail anymore, and I just pled guilty and paid the fine. I fundraised on my walk up there. I called it my silent winter hike because I maintained a pledge of silence for 22 days, and I camped out every night.
Talk about a little bit of the exchanges you had with people. Like, you camped out. We're talking about midwinter here, and this has been the toughest winter in New England that maybe I've seen in my lifetime, which is a lot of years. So were you camping out every night? Did you get hospitality anywhere?
I'd made a pledge that I was going to camp out every night. It was like a challenge kind of walk. But I was looking for people who would let me camp in their yard. And I discovered that probably about maybe one out of five people that I asked would let me.
So now you've walked down to Lusby, Maryland, where, or I guess you're going on trial with 19 other people. Just fill listeners in on exactly what you were protesting.
We're trying to stop the construction of Dominion Resources. It's an LNG liquefaction plant, and it uses huge amounts of energy. It uses the amount of energy of a middle-sized town power plant just to do the liquefaction of the fracked gas. And they'll load it on ships and sell it overseas where the price of gas is higher.
Actually, people are saying that will actually send the price of gas in this country up as well. So it's hard to find justification that it's in the U.S. public interest to be doing this. But nevertheless, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, did approve it last fall, and they are actually under construction now. So a lot of people are saying it's a done deal, and I've talked to some local folks here who were opposed, and they're saying, you know, most of the people around here are saying it's a done deal and there's nothing they can do even if they don't want it. But now with people coming in from the outside, supporters who are, you know, carrying out these actions and going to trial and willing to go to jail, they said now they feel like there's some hope to stop it. And do you feel that way too?
Yeah, I think so. I have to be hopeful. There are certain segment of people that have given in to despair, and they think the disruption, this ecological disaster, is just the way it needs to be. I don't think that's a good way to live, and I try to be positive and try to do whatever I can to help the situation. I think that's good for my mental health, and that's the way I want to be, and I want to be remembered that way. I have grandchildren. It's not just for my grandchildren. It's for their generation and future generations. This is what I want to do, and I'm really fortunate to be able to do it.
That was Charles Chandler, who goes by the name of Peace Walker. He and 19 others went on trial February 23rd in Maryland, where they were convicted of one count of trespass. Chandler and most others were given a 20-day suspended sentence, 3 years of probation, and a $157 fine. Chandler says he expects to be arrested again before the 3 years are up, increasing his chances of going to jail. Learn more about groups opposed to LNG export terminals, fracking, and climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A long grassroots battle to establish net neutrality rules was won on February 26th, when by a 3-2 vote, the Federal Communications Commission approved new regulations that reclassified broadband internet as a public utility under Title II of the Communications Act. The new rules prohibit internet service providers, including cellular carriers, from blocking, slowing down, or speeding up online traffic or giving priority to web services in exchange for payment. This victory for net neutrality advocates seemed unlikely less than a year ago, when in May 2014, FCC Chair Tom Wheeler proposed a tiered internet, where a fee-based system would determine the speed at which content would be delivered to consumers, a lucrative gift to telecom giants like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon. Public opposition to Wheeler's proposal came in a flood of 4 million comments sent to the FCC, objecting to the pay-to-play scheme. After President Obama announced his support for net neutrality rules under Title II, Wheeler switched his position, paving the way for the late February vote. Now that the new rules have been approved, the cable and telecom industries are poised to file lawsuits and pressure Congress to pass legislation that will disable or weaken net neutrality regulations. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, President and CEO of the media democracy group FreePress.net, one of the nation's leading net neutrality advocacy organizations. Here he discusses the significance of the recent FCC victory and the need for activists to stay vigilant to confront the coming industry attacks.
The FCC for years now and up until probably November or December of last year really seemed dead set on not taking the necessary steps to protect internet users and make the strongest rules. So it was that public pressure that really turned them around, which I think is so important. And of course, the other reason that I think this win is so crucial is because we're talking about the internet. And, you know, the internet is still a medium in which anybody with a good idea, something important to say, has an opportunity to find an audience. And if you look at the history of media, the history of media policy, it's been all about losing those opportunities. When radio came on, it was supposed to change everything, and it eventually got consolidated, television, cable television, and on down the list. The internet still hasn't been completely co-opted, and I think this victory was so huge, and really we've been fighting over these rules for the past 10 years, and to see it actually go in the public's direction and at the FCC, not simply by having to take them to court and win a court case or what have you, but actually get them to listen to the public and to go against some of the most powerful lobbyists in Washington in the phone and cable industry, it just really hasn't happened before.
Craig, I wanted to get your response to millions of dollars worth of TV ads paid for by the cable industry, warning the public that the new Title II rules that were voted in by the FCC to govern broadband internet will result in what they say are some $11 billion in new taxes and fees. Fact check for these claims, if you would.
Sure. Well, you know, this is the product of a study by an organization called the Progressive Policy Institute, which on its surface, that sounds pretty good, but it is a sort of a Democrat Leadership Council affiliated group, a third way affiliated group that has really just become a corporate front group in terms of their studies. And we looked at these claims and filed a lot of documents at the FCC to show that, you know, we believe them to be completely bogus, you know, sort of apples and oranges comparisons, worst case scenarios, assuming states are going to jack up taxes in all kind of ways that have never happened. And we couldn't find any evidence for taxes going up at all. And in fact, Congress recently re-upped the Internet Tax Freedom Act or Internet Freedom Tax Act. I forget exactly the order there, but which is a bill that Senator Ron Wyden put forward that basically eliminates any of these concerns. The senator himself has called them baloney. So, you know, this is really just the kind of scare tactics, you know, even though this has been so thoroughly debunked. I mean, even the Washington Post no real friend of net neutrality gave these claims three Pinocchios in their ad evaluating column. And yet it continues to pop up all over the place from members of Congress. Grover Norquist, the anti-tax crusader, has been using the numbers. They're really just bogus figures, but that's often what we're dealing with in these net neutrality debates.
Given that the industry, the cable industry, is so dead set against these rules, they're launching initiatives both to undermine the Title II designation, both legislatively and through lawsuits. Maybe you can run through what you think the biggest threats are to undermining this recent FCC net neutrality vote.
Sure, and they're definitely, the threats are very real. I think first and foremost, the threat comes from Congress. There's a lot of saber rattling going on right now, and I actually think the next month or so is going to be very crucial. There are already four or five hearings scheduled on Capitol Hill. There have already been two or three before the vote. They're going to drag the FCC up there. They're going to see if this is an issue that they want to take on. There's a couple ways Congress could interfere with this, something called a resolution of disapproval, where they actually try to overturn the regulation. This happened back in 2010 and cleared the House but failed in the Senate. That would require the president to sign on. There's also some more hidden ways, like cutting the FCC's budget, basically trying to make it so they can't spend any money to enforce these rules. That could happen. And there's sort of a split in the Republican Party. There are some Republicans who want to try for compromise legislation, which if done right could be a good answer. But the bills that have been shopped so far sort of look good at that surface level, but you scratch them at all and you realize for the long term they're taking away the FCC's ability to protect internet users from any kind of future harms we can't see today. So I think that's probably how the congressional threats will materialize. They'll be multifaceted. But the important thing, I think, for the average citizen out there is to let your member of Congress know that you support what the Federal Communications Commission did. You support net neutrality. You don't want them to mess with this. I mean, we certainly showed the FCC unprecedented amounts of public attention and pressure, and I think we have an opportunity to show Congress that the internet is not the thing that you want to mess with. And the Republicans are going to have to make a decision whether this is an issue they want to go to war on or not. I'm not sure it's a fight that they actually want. We're about to find out pretty soon.
That was Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group FreePress.net. Find more information on groups working to preserve and expand internet freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.